The McIlvaney Weekly Commentary, covering monetary, economic, and geopolitical news events.
To the degree that there is less financial cooperation and less free trade, we will see an increase in the price of real things that we buy and consume. So, you know, I think deglobalization serves as the perfect environment for a bear market in financial assets, which, again, if you go back to the countercyclical nature of gold, to the degree that we continue to march towards deglobalization, you have a perfect environment for a bull market in gold.
Now here are Kevin Orrick and David McIlvaney.
Welcome to the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary. I'm Kevin Orrick along with David McIlvaney. Often you're asked to fly somewhere and actually give an overall presentation as to what people should be doing. A lot of times it's in direct relation to gold itself. And, you know, we talk about the economy, the macro economy, reasons to own gold. We talk oftentimes never mentioning gold. What I'd like to do today, Dave, is you've just given a presentation that you've prepared for people who are not necessarily familiar with all the reasons for owning gold. And I asked you, I said, well, Dave, could we possibly just talk this through since you've prepared the presentation? You're giving it to people who aren't really familiar with this. I know our audience is, but let's just go back over some of the fundamentals in this program of why gold, because, you know, you're Dad saw this back going all the way to 1972, and actually, I would guess probably years before he even opened the firm. He started understanding economic history to the degree that when Nixon did close the gold window in August of 1971, it didn't take your dad long to try to figure out how to get gold in his own pocket and the pocket of his clients.
I think some of the assumptions that we operate off of is that investors swing between emotions of greed and fear. And that's what you see reflected in the price of assets. So whether it's the stock market, the bond market, real estate, gold, they reflect an underlying emotion. We can disconnect ourselves and forget that it's people making decisions, allocating assets that ultimately drive prices up or down. But behind those decisions, there is a rationale or a rationalization of what is being done.
Well, and you and I talked last week about having a deliberate plan. That's not an emotional plan. We're going to have emotions all the way through. Emotion, I one time heard that you're the mountain and the emotions are the clouds and the different weather that goes past that mountain. If you can stay solid in one point and stay disciplined, then it doesn't matter what the emotional ups and downs are, as long as you don't act outside of your deliberate practice.
Yeah, so navigation. Navigation is about a certain set of principles. And oftentimes on the program, we'll reference back to your history, my history with flying planes. And, you know, these ideas that the best pilots are the pilots that understand protocols, not the ones who literally fly by the seat of their pants.
Right.
You get into a certain set of circumstances, difficult circumstances, and you need to rely on your protocols. You need to have something that allows you to navigate what is a challenging set of circumstances and move you beyond feeling.
A good example of that, Dave, I learned to fly gliders, sailplanes, before I got my power license. And when I went to get my power license after flying gliders, it was interesting. One of the emergency procedures they had was what they called the power off landing. Well, emergency procedure? That's what a glider does. It's always a power off landing. You never have a prop in front of you. But what was interesting to me was my instructor would always become tense when we would pull the power back and practice power off landings, because my instructor had always seen it as an emergency. Now, going back to the investments, if again, we can detach from the emotions and say, okay, well, this isn't an emergency, or this isn't a period of time where greed should kick in. What is my deliberate practice? What's the triangle we've talked about? What's the mixture of what we should have? It doesn't really matter whether the stock market's rising or falling, or gold and silver is rising or falling, if we have an overall plan.
If you're reflecting on your own life, sometimes it's helpful to take the third person and almost remove yourself from yourself, look down, and what are the actions being taken? Why are they being taken? And if you can gain some sort of objective perspective, the third person perspective, instead of just living in the first person, it's really helpful. As an individual, when you're making decisions about relationships and things like that, I think it's even applicable in the world of finance and investing to, again, move yourself from the first person. What do I want in this moment? To removing yourself and almost looking at your long-term objectives, where you've been, where you're at, where you're going, as if you're looking at a timeline, as if you're removed from it and can judge it, again, devoid of those emotions, and just see what they are, the peaks and valleys in asset prices driven by greed and fear. How do you engage? When do you engage? This does get to the point of why gold and why the case for gold, I think, can be made in the midst of these market cycles.
Let's go ahead and talk about another thing we mentioned last week. Know who you are and know who you're not. Now, one of the things that we are not, being human, we're not predictors of the future. We can try, but we really don't know. So I want to start out, one of the greatest cases for gold is just to be human and say, I'm going to accept some of the uncertainties, whether it's political uncertainty, geopolitical uncertainty, market uncertainty. So let's start there. Let's go ahead and start with the political uncertainty of 2020.
Right. So the future is not knowable. That's, again, one of these assumptions that we have. The future is not knowable. It is not determined, and we cannot see what's going to happen. We do know that people react differently according to a certain set of circumstances. How they feel ends up impacting their actions. So if you look at what gold has been for 5,000 years, really, basically, it's been money. And it's only since 1971 and forward that you would say, in a world where gold is no longer treated as money, that it plays a different role and function within a portfolio construct, that of insurance. So we can talk about it as money in its historical sense. We can also talk about it in its present context as a tool that provides insurance. Insurance against what? This is where the fact that gold operates on a countercyclical basis to other assets is incredibly valuable, because to the degree that you have boom and bust cycles in stocks and bonds and real estate, so you have an asset that sits there in opposition or in balance to those boom and bust cycles, intends to move in the opposite direction. So to the degree that stocks are doing well, you have less of an audience for gold. And again, you've got that environment really defined by greed. People don't see the need for insurance. And so what happens is people move away from gold ownership and more towards speculation. And the more those stories find success, what you have is people wanting to then add leverage to that speculation. And things get riskier and riskier as the greed cycle plays out. And ultimately, this is one of the reasons why, generally speaking, the declines in asset prices are severe and quick, because the dynamics have become very, very fragile. The inputs have become very fragile.
Okay, Dave, let's go ahead and go to that. It's interesting how often I talk to somebody and they think the stock market's going to keep going up because they like Trump. And it's like, you think the stock market might be too high even though Trump's in office? Well, see, that's a misunderstanding. Now, whoever your candidate is, this isn't picking a candidate, but what it is there's a misunderstanding that being certain of a political outcome is sort of certain of a financial market outcome. And if you look at presidents throughout history, the president has nothing to do with stock market cycles.
But the economy, if you want to think of the economy as sort of the expression of businesses all doing what they do best, there is a cycle within the world of business. Sometimes businesses are doing very well. Sometimes they are not. One of the primary ingredients to a booming business cycle or a booming economy is liquidity in the system. So liquidity conditions are absolutely critical. This is one of the cornerstones of the coursework that I did at the Edinburgh Business School. And, you know, liquidity is what drives asset prices. If you have excess liquidity in the system, in the economy, then asset prices tend to boom. If there is a deficiency or not enough liquidity in the system, then asset prices are constrained. They tend to fall.
It's funny you say that, because I was just telling someone, after 33 years, I've been through three major stock market crashes. One in 1987, one in 2000 when the tech stock bubble blew up, and then, of course, 2008. And the only real sign, because before all three of those, the stock market was hitting all-time highs, everything was fine. The only thing that actually gave us an indication that something was wrong was the liquidity started to dry up. And, you know, you think about since September, Dave, we've talked about the repo markets and the government buying 80% of its treasuries back and QE4. We seem to have a potential drying up of liquidity if the government weren't intervening, even going on right now.
Well, so if we remember that liquidity is a key element and then look back again at the history, let's say the last 100 years, one of the significant things that's changed is liquidity was naturally constrained under the gold standard and under the Bretton Woods system.
Because you couldn't print it out of thin air.
Right. We were tied to gold. That was an anchor. It was a limiting factor. We eliminated that factor in 71. And it means that the credit boom that we've had through the 70s, 80s, 90s, and aughts.
It's a borrowed boom.
It is a borrowed boom. And it's no longer just about liquidity at the margin, a little bit more or a little bit less, you know, which defined the little booms and the little busts that we had. The business cycle used to be fairly modest. Now we have the ability to manipulate and drive the business cycle beyond what would be a normal cycle. And that's being done with basically the printing press. Where have we gotten in the last several months is the Fed has begun to increase its balance sheet again, close to $400 billion in assets that have hit the balance sheet since September. Is it any surprise that we had a spectacular fourth quarter for stocks?
Quite different than 2018 when they weren't doing that and the stock market was having a temper tantrum.
Well, and again, this focuses on this issue of liquidity because what was happening is you actually had a reduction in Fed balance sheet there in the fourth quarter of 2018. And there were tightening financial conditions in the fourth quarter of 2018. And of course, 2019 was defined by the Powell U-turn. And instead of a tightening of financial conditions, a loosening of financial conditions and a creation of excess liquidity, which has given us a boom in asset prices. But it's monetary stimulus, which has given us outperformance in stocks, bonds, and what have you. Now, very interestingly, I think this gets to, and we will get to politics because you asked about uncertainty a minute ago, but very interestingly, you look at gold's move higher in 2019, and it is not typical for gold to move higher with risk assets. In fact, it usually, as we said earlier, is countercyclical.
That's parallel with the stock market is what you're saying.
That's right. Yeah. So what is fascinating to me, and I think is kind of a hallmark of a trend change, is there is enough buyers. These are investors who are saying, yep, good ride. Fantastic on the upside with all of our other risk assets, but it's time to start doing something else. It's time to begin diversifying into a liquid asset that is financial in nature, but not within the financial system. So it doesn't have the same vulnerabilities when you're talking about derivative complexity, when you're talking about counterparty risk. These are the merits that gold has. And the fact that gold began to move aggressively to the upside at the same time the Fed's balance sheet is expanding and we're putting in all-time highs in the stock market, which one of these does not look like the other? I would say gold, because even though price action was positive, and on that basis you could paint it with the same color, it is moving for a different reason. It's bought on the basis of concern, not on the basis of speculation. Typically. And there are smart money players, particularly in the hedge fund community globally, who are saying, we don't see these liquidity provisions from the Fed ultimately being sustainable. In fact, at some point, they're going to have to trim back a lot of this excess. This is, in fact, the challenge that the Chinese have today. The Chinese pumped in trillions of dollars, just shy of $4 trillion into their economy last year through, again, liquidity provisions. You pump it out there because you're trying to stabilize the economy and make sure that there's as much as needed, maybe a little bit more.
At the same time, they're buying all the gold. It's been amazing the amount of buying that the Chinese have been doing. So they're offsetting, obviously, whoever's creating the liquidity, just like the central bankers worldwide.
Yep.
They're also buying a lot of gold because they know where this leads.
So again, if we go back to this idea of greed and fear being the dominating factors that drive investor decisions, then what drives fear? What changes the mindset or the feeling in the marketplace? And this is where I think uncertainty is the word which could be broadly applied to multiple categories: political uncertainty, geopolitical uncertainty, and financial market uncertainty. And those three categories, any of them or all of them in combination, can shift the mindset of an investor from being greed-oriented and growth-oriented to sort of battening down the hatches, protecting assets, making sure that you have return of capital instead of return on capital. And that, I think, is very probable. Why? Well, political uncertainty 2020, this is something that we don't have a guaranteed outcome. As you said a moment ago, we don't know who wins.
Well, I'll bet you we do know, however, that they're going to spend money. One of the things you've been talking about for the last 4 or 5 years, Dave, is when the monetary policy, all of this central bank manipulation, when that monetary policy starts to wane and it looks like it's not working as well, which I would say since September, we've seen that, then you're going to have fiscal spending. You remember the old Keynesian schooling that we got? You either use monetization or you use fiscal spending. You either go to war or build a bridge.
Well, so here's fascinating. Again, looking at 2019, we looked at monetary policy and applied it in a different way than has been done before. Monetary policy is typically an intervention used in the context of a market decline or an economic decline to infuse new life into something that is having problems. We saw Jerome Powell infuse fresh life into the stock market at all-time highs and with employment at 50-year lows, with wages on the increase. I mean, this is, I think, the first time that I can recall in monetary policy history where the Fed has aggressively implemented monetary policy and it's not been to save the system. Right. That wasn't the justification. It was to make sure that we maintained a stable and upward trajectory. So this quote unquote insurance rate cuts, three of them this last year, were meant to keep the trend going. But again, money was coming in. Liquidity was created and being pushed in, not in the midst of financial crisis, but in the midst of, really, you could argue, financial excess. Stocks trading at all time highs, 128 months of continual growth. I mean, this is
the longest
really
in history, isn't it?
Yeah. So what we should see with fiscal policy, again, fiscal policy is typically used, and the Keynesian argument to use fiscal policy is to prop up quote unquote aggregate demand. You spend when others are not spending. So the government steps in when corporations are reining things back and when individuals are too afraid. Maybe they're afraid of the pink slip, or they're afraid of, you know, what may happen next. They're dealing with the emotional ramifications of a 401k having shrunk 30 or 40 or 50%, and they're just tightening their belts, right?
Well, so for the person who's saying, what's the matter with fiscal policy? There's nothing the matter with it, except for the fact that we don't have the money to build a bridge. We have to borrow it. We have to create it.
Well, so what's fascinating is not only was monetary policy pro-cyclical in this cycle, but I think fiscal policy, again, it may not actually have to wait for an emergency. I don't know that Trump has a problem spending an extra $1 trillion if he thinks he can improve economic figures and look like a hero.
Okay, but does that mean he'll have to keep interest rates low? We can't keep paying interest on debt as we build it.
Of course.
So what is the potential for lower interest rates?
The math only works. The math only works if he can keep interest rates low, right? But take the alternative, Trump loses, and pick anyone from the Democratic scoreboard. Who's winning now? Who's going to win? We don't know. But regardless of who wins the nomination for the Democrats, again, we're already on track with current commitments for $1 trillion in fiscal deficit spending, according to the Congressional Budget Office, every year for the next 10 years. That's not including Trump's pet projects, which he can hatch a dozen of them in 2021, or any Democrat for that matter. They can come up with another, you know, 10 ways to spend $1 trillion in addition to the trillion which is already committed in terms of being added to the national debt. So this is where the pivot to fiscal policy, it may not be in the context of a market that's falling to pieces, where fiscal policy is required. We've already seen pro-cyclical monetary policy. Why wouldn't we see pro-cyclical fiscal policy? And I think this is, again, where gold is suggesting to you there are currency ramifications to overcommitting on the debt side. There are currency ramifications to making too many commitments without a clear way of knowing that you can't actually pay them back. And the belief is they can sit on interest rates and control that. What you find in terms of the study of market history is that rates get lower and lower and lower and lower. And with that lowering of rates comes a belief that they are in control. They, in this case being the central banks, the Fed, the ECB, Bank of Japan, the Bank of England, what have you. But when markets drive interest rates to higher levels, now you're talking about a market-driven liquidity tightening, what happens to the system when liquidity is tightening, interest rates are ratcheted higher, and you've got a mountain of debt. So this is why, again, this political uncertainty is very key. And the pivot to fiscal policy, I think, is a major contributor to the direction of gold over the next 2, 3, 4 years. I don't care who wins. It doesn't matter if Trump is in office, because a part of his goal to stimulate growth in the economy is to abuse the debt system. This is not a fiscal conservative. He's never put himself out there as a fiscal conservative. And in fact, I think he'll spend even more in 2021 if he's elected.
There's nobody on the platform.
Democrats or Republicans.
Conservative.
Right. So the potential for lower rates, if the Fed found themselves in a panic, they would certainly do everything they could to lower rates. We've seen that over and over again. The interventionist tendencies have been on display for the past 10 years, and that's not likely to cease. But again, that variable that no one can really calculate is when investors start to move the other direction on the basis of feeling, where greed fades, fear becomes more of a prominent thematic, and all of a sudden interest rates are rising. That is a negative when you've got as much debt as we have in the system, private, corporate, governmental, particularly corporate and governmental. On this last round, 2008 to the present, those areas have just blown sky high.
Well, and one of those things that might create some of that fear, look globally for a moment, because a lot of times we as Americans just sort of look at ourselves as a closed system. But nationalism, populism, all those things are starting to rise. And, you know, they feel it more overseas right now. We're feeling it, the polarity between the Democrat and the Republican. You know, you've got the impeachment stuff. But in reality, we're probably not going to have this state of just catharsis, basically, go on for forever where they can keep interest rates low. They have to borrow from somebody but themselves, Dave. That's really the bottom line on interest rates. You have to borrow from somebody and you have to pay them enough interest for them to want to loan it to you. They just haven't had to do that yet because the government's been able to borrow from themselves.
I think, again, the same thematic of political uncertainty applies just as much overseas, as you say, globally. And so, you know, when you have growth economically, typically there's a backdrop of peace and cooperation. And so when people start thinking more selfishly about their own individual or nationalist needs, economic nationalism or, you know, what have you. Populism is really just, you know, one word for economic nationalism, where you have, you know, contentious political parties or real concern about, you know, the direction of a country. Those issues in the backdrop end up creating a context where you can end up with major financial market uncertainty. So we'll get that in a minute. But I want to say that the political uncertainty that we have globally factors in a major way. I spoke at an economics conference, South Africa, 2017.
Mm-hmm.
And so almost 3 years ago. And my whole spiel was on the nature of economic nationalism and populism, the rise of populism. This is really before we had the Five Star Movement and Syriza and some of these other groups in Europe. Now we see it in real time here in the United States. Again, it's divided and divisive political parties. But I'm telling you, these are the kinds of backdrop issues which create uncertainty, which ultimately drives investors to say, I can't see the future. I don't think tomorrow is necessarily going to be better than today. I can't say for sure. And that political uncertainty begins to change the investment calculus, the decision-making process for an individual. That's why gold ends up playing well in periods of political uncertainty.
Well, and you talk about populism, that's sort of a bottom-up stress. But if you look at some of the top-down stress, let's go to geopolitical uncertainty in 2020, because China, you know, they really are a new superpower competition. I want to go on and start looking at this competition in the Middle East for the caliphate. You know, the caliphate's not something that you and I have had during our lifetime, but there's a movement back to that, the old Ottoman Empire, whoever's going to control those reins. So what would you say about geopolitical uncertainty as we move into the next year?
It's a major issue. I mean, to sum it up, it's a major issue. And you can look at Europe and the disintegration there, both on the fiscal side and the political side, kind of a trend of deglobalization, which is sort of broadly speaking impacting the whole world. And this is not just about China and the US and their trade issues. China, as you mentioned, this is far greater an issue than trade competition, is superpower competition. Since the end of the Cold War, we haven't had a single country. There was a block of countries, the Euro, which for many years looked like it might surpass and overtake in importance the United States, and US dollar hegemony was certainly on the table in terms of being questionable as the euro continued to march higher and higher and higher. Of course, the global financial crisis upended that, and the thesis of replacement by the euro bloc is no longer really defensible, at least not at this point. China, on the other hand, continues to march higher. You could argue that a lot of their growth is bought with debt and is ultimately not sustainable. Maybe they don't care. They don't have a next generation to worry about. The one-child policy gutted them. So, you know, it's not like they're enslaving the next generation. The next generation barely exists. They've got major demographic issues along with major banking and financial market issues. And so China being a competition for us, it plays out in several ways. One, economically, there are greater and greater competition. But two, you can look and see that geographically, they are expanding their reach. We started talking about this 2-3 years ago in terms of their nine dash line. The nine dash line was this arbitrary line that they drew. You know, you pull out some old maps, and these old maps show that you have, you know, sort of, these are our navigable waterways, and this is where we go to fish and to trade and whatever. But they all of a sudden defined that nine dash line as something that was really implying ownership, implying control, and it stretches well into international waters. In fact, it stretches into, you know, the Philippine territories and Japanese territories. And so you have the Spratlys and a number of different islands, which have become major flashpoints in recent years.
Well, and that's as old as the Navy itself, any Navy itself, because if you go back 500 years, the Spanish and the Portuguese, they were trying to define how they were going to divide up the world with their own navies, and they went to the Catholic Church, and the Catholic Church had to decide. So, you know, a lot of world history has to do with where the line is drawn somewhere in the water.
Well, but there's also, lest we forget, we've had a year full of massive chaos in Hong Kong, right? And Hong Kong, we have yet to see real resolution there. We've had an election in Taiwan, which the mainland is not happy with at all. Again, an expression of nationalism and pushback from the mainland expressing autonomy, right? So you've got these trends towards autonomy. China at some point may need an excuse to get a little heavy-handed. And maybe it is their financial market problems which justify kind of moving above and beyond the scale and scope of force that they've used to date.
A few years ago, we had Dr. Friedman on of Stratfor, and he talked about what the American presence in the Middle East did in Iraq was actually create a vacuum for the caliphate to fill. He talked about the vacuum. Iraq was what sort of separated Iran on the east from Turkey on the west. And he said, there's going to be a winner, one side or the other. That will be the movement toward the caliphate. Now, of course, once we hollowed that area out, when Saddam Hussein, who was a tyrant, once he was taken out, we started to see that. And we actually, as recently as 3 weeks ago, Dave, have seen this movement of Iran into Iraq, and we've seen the outcome of that. So Middle East, is the Middle East even a factor? I mean, it seemed like things changed really quick with Iran, and then all of a sudden they shut up just as soon as we took out their second in command.
You know, in the 21st century, if you're a student of geography, you know where boundaries exist. If you're a student of geography in earlier periods, the boundaries were not arbitrary lines on a map. They were tied to limitations like mountains and oceans, and these were kind of the things that hemmed you in or created structural protection, or your places where you literally could not go or could not control. The caliphate is interesting because it's a religious entity that doesn't know or respect any of those things. It doesn't see that mountains are a hindrance or oceans are a hindrance, or even the arbitrary lines determined by states, by those who govern us in terms of international relations. All of that is arbitrary and meaningless. The caliphate is a world rule.
It's a different kind of government, a little like the Roman Catholic Church sort of is. If you think about it, it's religious / political.
But it's meant to be an all-encompassing and universal in its application. So I think that's interesting because the Middle East, as you say, the vacuum's created. It has yet to be resolved. There's still contentious issues between, you know, Turkey and Germany. So that ties into Europe and sort of pressure points there. If you're talking about immigration issues, Syria, Turkey, and Germany, that's been a massive, massive issue to deal with politically. And it's one of the things that is upending the whole Merkel structure and party in Germany. But the Middle East is kind of up for grabs, and we are not helping all that much in defining who will be in control. We created the vacuum, or helped create the vacuum, and now there is a real desire to fill that vacuum. Where do we go from here? Again, this just defines uncertainty. Again, we come back to a thesis on gold. Geopolitical uncertainty helps to obscure what the future may be and bring in variables and risks which cannot fully be accounted for, which the intelligent investor is going to say, I've got to create something of a hedge. Again, if gold was money for 5,000 years, but is now not treated as money, instead serves an insurance function, then there are a number of geopolitical outcomes, including what can happen in the Middle East, as we've seen with Iran here most recently, and certainly Israel facing an existential threat on a routine basis. These are issues. These are issues, and they remain central to a 2020-2021 focus.
You know, we've defined before the difference between globalism and globalization. Globalism is a movement toward a one world type of government, and I think a lot of people, including me, would not be for that. Globalization is different. Globalization is actually just being able to trade with other nations in a smooth basis. And what we've seen with the trade wars and things like that is the tensions are rising between nations. You had mentioned nationalism when you were talking about political uncertainty. For years, we've sort of assumed that countries are going to continue to trade with each other peacefully and not start to penalize each other. And that's what we've been seeing. So that seems to me a setup for a bear market, because people are not going to want to buy stocks and companies that may ultimately be shut out of a country.
Yeah, the benefit of globalization would be similar to the benefits argued like in Henry Hazlitt's book, Economics in One Lesson, where, you know, if you can specialize in one thing and I can specialize in one thing and we can put our energy together, we can create many more things by having focused our energies and productivity and efforts on one thing.
So it's symbiotic, yeah.
Correct. So this is the nature of creating a pencil. I don't want to be both the timber man and the rubber man and the lead man. If I have to be all those things, I'm going to produce one pencil a week. But if I can focus on the wood and you can focus on that, we can produce millions of pencils in a week. And so again, there's this notion that globalization allows for specialization and cooperation and mutual benefits.
Well, and it keeps prices low on the actual item. I would imagine it would also increase the price and probably create inflation.
This is one of the things that I think is going to come as a great surprise. Today, we do have product gluts. We have global overcapacity. But that's one of the things that we've have benefited from as consumers, is in the world of globalization, we have overcapacity and consumer prices have been dampened as a result, to the degree that there is less financial cooperation and less free trade. We will see an increase in the price of real things that we buy and consume. So, you know, I think deglobalization serves as the perfect environment for a bear market in financial assets, which again, if you go back to the countercyclical nature of gold, a bear market in financial assets is a bull market in gold. And so to me, to the degree that we continue to march towards deglobalization, you have a perfect environment for a bull market in gold.
Well, another perfect environment for a bear market, say in the stock market, is just paying too much for it to start. And, you know, anytime we've seen the price earnings ratio get up above 20, 25, we've always seen it come back down below that, always. And we're at the second highest valuation. When we go to the financial markets, let's move to financial markets. When we look at valuations, Dave, people are paying over 30 times, 30 years of earnings on average for the stock market right now.
Yeah, and we like to use the Shiller PE, the cyclically adjusted price earnings ratio, not your standard PE because it takes out the gamesmanship of your executives who like to actually push those earnings up and down just so they can benefit from a compensation standpoint. Right. That may come as a surprise. Some of our listeners might not know that, but you can intentionally drive up and down your earnings.
But the way Shiller calculates it, it's very hard to manipulate that.
Exactly. Yeah. It gives you a clearer picture of where you're at. It's not a trading device, but it is something that certainly helps with context. So valuations, you're right, price to sales, highest ever. Price to earnings, second highest ever. The Buffett ratio, which compares the replacement value of stocks to, and this is all drawn from the Fed Z1 report, the replacement value of stocks compared to the underlying economy, what he considers to be the best measure, or has in the past.
He's comparing it to GDP, right?
Yeah. So on Buffett's favorite measure, we're now second most expensive market and may in fact become the first most expensive stock market. Again, we come back to this issue of greed and fear. We come back to how do you navigate? How do you take the third person, step away and say, where are we at in the cycle? Is it worth not engaging in a year's worth of income, 2 years worth of income, 3 years worth of growth? This was our conversation with Andrew Smithers 4 or 5 years ago, and he basically said, I don't care how much growth is in stocks today. I'm not of an age where I can afford to play the patience game for 10, 15, 20 years as the stock market comes back from a major decline. I would rather be in cash, in bonds, rather than in stocks. And that was his move. Actually, he's probably done quite well in the bond market, given that it's gone through a parabolic move higher as rates have gotten crushed to nothing.
Know who you are and know who you're not. He knew he was probably not going to live long enough to go through a full cycle.
Oh, that's right. But he knew where he was at in the cycle.
Yeah.
And it was late stage 5 years ago, right? We were already at an expensive level then, and we're at a very, very, very expensive level now.
Okay. If you're a company and you think the economy is just chugging along, you're going to produce an awful lot of product. To the point, and one of the things that we learn in economics is economic cycles are produced oftentimes from supply deficits and gluts, you know, and if we move into a period of time, you know, the Chinese are good at this. Chinese are really good at making an awful lot of something that maybe nobody's going to buy just to make a lot of something. Do we have product glut issues coming up?
Yeah. And again, we look at the benefits of ending the Cold War, and we lowered our labor costs considerably by bringing the world together at the end of the Cold War. So labor costs have come down considerably. When we could start building plants and infrastructure in other places, all of a sudden we could outsource many of those things which weren't as necessary to create here in the United States. And it gave us the ability to buy things much cheaper. Is one of the things, we cannot create inflation, consumer price inflation, in a world of rock bottom labor costs, $1 a day, $5 a day, $10 a day, when everything that you consume is being produced for virtually nothing somewhere overseas. You know, and the Fed is now trying to drive inflation higher. What if you get this perfect storm where deglobalization is occurring, trade and cooperation is diminishing, the cost of labor is going up, and thus the cost of in products is also going up at the same time that from a monetary policy standpoint, the central bank is trying to increase inflation. Could you perhaps overshoot inflation on the upside? Here's the real negative consequence there. If you overshoot inflation on the upside, even a little bit, interest rates have to reflect that. The bond market is very sensitive to inflation. Again, you don't need a massive increase in interest rates to see a massive repricing in the financial markets where debt all of a sudden has to accommodate actual inflation, real inflation, increasing inflation, anticipated inflation. So we have way too much debt, right? We have way too much debt to accommodate any change in variables. And I think one of those things could be inflation. So to the contrary, what we've had in terms of a benefit, consumer prices at a low level.
And that's been caused by the glut.
And passed through to us. Yeah.
Okay.
A glut of products. And low labor costs. So these are two inputs into the inflation figures, which have been a benefit to us. I don't think we can count on that moving forward. But this is the interesting thing. In a world full of debt, in a world that is massively leveraged, when we look at the financial markets, and if you want to define the greatest levels of uncertainty in this space, it's what about the variables that we believe to be constant, which actually are not constant which cannot be controlled and may actually surprise moving the other direction. We talked about just a few weeks ago, we talked about 100-year bonds and the fact that they're trading at, you know, 2%, 3%. That does not accommodate
inflation. Talk about certainty. That's false certainty.
It's false certainty.
It's certainty.
It's false certainty because it assumes that you know something about the future that you don't actually know, right? And that's where we start our assumptions with you cannot know the future. Anytime that you begin to presume that you know the future, you're mispricing an asset.
I just got off the phone with a man who had purchased a lot of gold before he knew me in 2011. He had come out of the stock market late after the crash in 2008.
Sold at lows.
He went into the gold market in 2011, which was the high.
Bought at highs.
He'll still get past those numbers at some point. But then he sold a bunch of gold today. Okay. And he says, I'm going to go back into the stock market because I'm just bullish. He says, I looked over at Brittany, who works with me, and I said, Brittany, this is a classic example of human nature. Now, I'm not trying to criticize him because I'm this way too. It's easy to do, but he is at the peak of bullishness when everybody else is. And that's almost a perfect indicator of one market being too high.
But this is, again, if you're in the first person, you can say, I am bullish. And I'm not saying there's anything illegitimate with that. But if you're able to move to the third person and reflect on who you are, where you're at in the market cycles of greed and fear, you may, in the first person, say, I am bullish. And in the third person, say, you are stupid.
Yeah, so hold me back. Somebody stop me.
That's right. And you can hold yourself back. You
That's
can.
Right.
That's called self-restraint. It's called the disciplines that you engage with, the protocols that you put in place to be able to manage wealth through generations.
Okay, but bullish sentiment, when it reaches this kind of high, I mean, they can do polls on this. When you reach this kind of high where everybody, virtually everybody's bullish, that's usually an indicator that there's going to be a reversal.
There's a couple ways of measuring that. They have a daily sentiment indicator, which just in the last recent weeks have been between 89 and 92%. Again, these are like the highest of the high levels that you'll see in terms of bullish sentiment in the stock market. Now, if you gauge and ask specific questions to investors, the numbers come out a little differently. 59.4% bulls, 17.9% bears. And anytime there's over a 40% differential, you are categorically in the high risk zone, meaning you're at a market peak. You are putting in a top right there when that differential between bulls and bears is greater than 40%. Hmm. So where are we? We know where we're at. And again, bullish sentiment, these are contrary indicators because why contrary? Because everyone's happy. Everyone's bullish. Nothing's been done in the stock market. Nothing's happened yet where people are afraid. But this is why it's a contrary sentiment indicator.
You know, I read a sort of a terrible story of human nature, but it's one to learn from. It was a book on survival, and in the urban setting, it happened just before the second tower got hit in 2001. The first tower got hit with the airplane. People came out of the second tower, and then they were all told to go back to their office, that would be the safest place to be. Now, the story was told from someone who went the opposite direction. So when everybody's thinking the same, you know, you had all these people streaming back up into their offices, and tragically, you know, that was not the safest place to be. The person who survived was the one going, no, I'm not going to do that. When everybody's going one direction, I'm going another.
Right. So Rick Resclora, we've talked about him many times on the commentary. He was risk manager, kind of an on the ground risk manager for Morgan Stanley. And he'd march executives in $5,000 pinstripe suits down the stairs during days where they're doing fire drills. And he expected them, didn't matter what their meeting schedule was, this is a fire drill and we're going to practice this.
And you're leaving the building.
Yeah. He didn't care
right.
How much you made or how expensive your suit was. This is a guy who was a soldier of fortune in Africa in an earlier period of his life and a playwright and poet, alongside being head of risk management for Morgan Stanley. And again, we're not talking about derivatives risk management. We're talking about sort of, you know, functional
physical
risk management.
Management,
but yeah. This is a guy who, before the attack on the World Trade Center in 94, called it. He said, this is our vulnerability. This is where it's going to happen. Within years, it happened. After 94, he said, this is our vulnerability. It's in the sky. We will get hit by a plane at some point. That's how it happened. Hmm. So being able to see the future and anticipate risk, it's a very interesting mindset. But this is a guy who would not let those in the second tower go back to their offices. He was following protocol. The good pilot does that. Huh. You don't see how it feels. And, well, I have a good feeling about it. I'm just going to go back to my desk. And by the way, somebody in authority is telling me it's okay. okay, this is a guy who is following protocols, get out of the building.
So seat of the pants, which going back to pilots, seat of the pants, that can get you into trouble.
Right. I think this issue of financial market uncertainty, it really is what defines where we go 2020 and 2021, what defines the gold market moving forward, because we already know we have the context of too much debt, and we've been able to forestall a day of reckoning.
Well, isn't that the problem? We don't really feel the pain as long as we can borrow more money.
And we are. We're borrowing more and more money. That means that we have an unstable financial backdrop to begin with, and we have the belief that we can control interest rates, and central banks have proven that they can to a certain degree. The Scandinavians are already ready. They're moving away from a zero and negative interest rate policy, saying, actually, it's costing us more than we originally calculated, and it is not bringing us the benefits that we had hoped for. But that doesn't mean that the whole central bank community is going to follow the Scandinavians as they start to increase interest rates. The trend has been towards lower and lower rates so that you can control the math. Having too much debt creates terminal situations, right? Too much debt is not good. It's what defines vulnerability in the marketplace. And this presumption of control is we will keep interest rates low. It's in our bailiwick to do so. But this is, again, I wish people could look at all the interest rate charts that I have on the walls and in the books that chronicle this presumption. It's over and over and over again. Rates come lower and lower and lower, and they hit historic lows. They're at their lowest points ever just before they spike. In other words, you believe you're in control until complete control is lost.
Right.
That's what a chart on interest rates looks like. It's a perfect world until it's a deadly, dangerous, and upside down world.
Then you have to actually start paying people for risk again. Okay, so let's move away from uncertainty, because yeah, we've got political, we've got geopolitical, we've got financial uncertainty. But one thing we do have for sure is, as of 2009, the central bankers started buying far more gold than they were selling. We've got the chart, and it's really amazing. They seem to have noticed something that we didn't back in 2009 as a world, and that is, this whole printing of paper thing has an end.
Yeah, we can pretend that this is working, and it will work in terms of a PR campaign.
Right.
We will bring peace and calm to the market
until we can get our
basis.
Gold. Yeah, get our gold in the meantime.
But while we are perpetuating this temporary peace in the marketplace, we better be fortifying our own balance sheets. And that's what we've seen. 2009 to the present, central banks have been the first buyer in the marketplace.
Well, 2018 was a record for central bank buying. 2019 was higher, a new record.
That's right. So we've seen the demand dynamics there very healthy. Investor demand dynamics in Asia and in Europe in recent years very healthy. So when we start talking about financial market uncertainty, we're really talking about the U.S. markets as a litmus for health for the global economy and for the U.S. economy. The U.S. markets begin to sell off. Now you have much greater financial market uncertainty here in the U.S., and U.S. investors join what is already the bandwagon of central bank buyers.
Right.
And international investors. It's now just the U.S. investor who's a little bit late to the party. And here we are, $1,500 gold off of $1,050 just a few years ago. Still probably a value proposition relative to financial assets, and still nowhere near the peaks, as we've seen new peaks put in a variety of currencies around the world last year.
Well, not that I want to get too technical on this, but let's just go back. We talked about 2011 being the very highest on gold, but we have support on charts. You mentioned charts. We have support levels. We have resistance levels. Looking forward into 2020, Dave, what should we be looking at on the charts?
Yeah, short term, you should be concerned. Not concerned as in the market's going away, but because there's reason for us to be bumping our heads up against the ceiling. We saw the gold price drop in 2012, 2013, and it temporarily found some support. We're now on those chart points bumping up against what were the low points back in 2012. That's the resistance we have to get above. So from a long-term perspective, very bullish. We have zero resolution, in my opinion, to what defines political uncertainty in the period ahead, what defines geopolitical uncertainty in the period ahead, and what defines financial market uncertainty in the period ahead. But what we do have is some technical chart points to get over in the interim. Short term, what that means is there's going to be some decent buying opportunities. Prices should drop back, I don't know, $20, $50, $60. We're not talking about a catastrophic decline in gold, but it's also not going to go screaming higher. It's very ordinary, very common for it to take time to get above significant technical resistance. And we have, in those 2012 chart points, significant technical resistance. I will tell you this, getting above those levels, getting above, say, the 1580, 1600 level, we're done. We can wake up the next morning and be very close to the old highs, 1900. So getting above those resistance points, all of a sudden, you find there's a lot more investors who are willing to put capital in, and you can see a lot of activity there. So above 1600, I think gold goes very quickly back to around 2000.
Okay. So the short term, you know, if you're trying to do some trading, go ahead and, you know, wait for a pullback sometimes. But long term, Dave, and this is always the trap. Like, don't give me a price, because guys all the time are like 5,000, 10,000, 50,000. They just come up with stuff. It really doesnesn't matter what the long term is, because it's how much the dollar will fall in buying power over time.
Well, right.
But what do you think long term?
This is a super important point, because, I mean, keep in mind that the best performing stock market last year was Venezuela. Up 5,000%.
Right.
Now, but
right.
What is 5,000%?
Well, look at the German stock market in the 20s.
Well, exactly. Yeah. So yeah. When you're talking about price and percentage gains, these things become irrelevant if you don't have a monetary anchor. And I think this is one of the things that we've lost in this 30 to 40 year credit market melt up without gold being treated as money. We don't have any reference for any assets.
Right.
So what does it all mean? What does it all mean?
Okay. But that takes us to the conversation of last week. Okay. We do have a solid valuation if we're looking at gold versus silver.
Marking value according
platinum to ratios. Platinum versus palladium, stocks versus gold. And take the currency out of it, because when guys go, oh, it's going to be $5,000, it's like, well, what are you basing that on?
Yeah, I think relative to stocks in 2020, we could see the ratio improve from 18.8, where we're at currently, to say the 15s. So the mid-teen level. And maybe 2021, we even see single digits. Again, some of these things are defined. The traffic into gold and the traffic out of stocks, there's those two variables, decline in price on the one hand, in stocks, increase in the price on the other. Those factors today are hypothetical, but you can see the ratio shift pretty dramatically when both of them are moving at the same time. So to go from 18.8 down to 6, it's not going to take very long.
Right.
It's not going to take very long. And then it might take more time to go from 6 to 5 to 4 to 3 to 2. But ultimately, what we talked about a few weeks ago when we were talking about how to double your ounces, that is long-term strategy applied to a hard asset portfolio, applied to gold, utilizing your insurance as something that multiplies wealth for generations to come.
Well, and if you're a listener that has not listened to last week's program, make sure you go back to that. It's the Double Your Ounces program. It's more conceptual than just doubling your ounces. And so definitely listen to that. We'll send you the report if you want. We have many calls after last week's show. Dave, I want to bring up something that we haven't talked about in a few weeks, and that is there are a lot of people these days who they have too much sitting in the bank, but they also need that money down the road. Maybe they've bought their gold. Maybe they've bought their silver, their platinum, and they're sitting there going, well, I've gotten everything that I'm going to receive here at home and everything that I'm going to store for now. But yeah, I've got a bunch in the bank account. I'm building a house maybe in the next 2 years. I want this to be protected. You develop something called Vaulted, which allows people to move money from their bank account directly into gold, and then really just simply online back into the bank account if that money's needed for liquidity. Talk about that just a little bit.
I love the transparency of the process and of that program, the Vaulted program. At vaulted.com, if you haven't seen it, you should check it out. And, you know, dealing with conflict-free gold, again, maybe 30 years ago, that wasn't as big a deal, but the Royal Canadian Mint is very keen on delivering not only a quality product, but understanding the provenance, where that gold came from. So from an ethical standpoint, I think there's a strong pillar to build upon there. Banking and savings is really the object with Vaulted to create an alternative. You know, during periods of currency stability, if the dollar's flat and stable, you might say, well, I don't need it.
Right.
But in periods of currency instability, it's the kind of thing where you have to make two choices, not only to work with a bank that won't lose your money. That's where we do some bank ratings for folks and let them know the stability of the institution they're working with. But something we mentioned last week, you know, when we were talking about 100-year bonds with Oxford, it's not that Oxford might be unreliable, but the pound sterling might be unreliable.
Sure.
So whither does the Brexit scenario take you in terms of the value of pound sterling going into the future, to a higher level or a lower level? You have to determine, if your savings are in pound sterling, how stable the underlying currency is.
Well, okay.
And that's why Vaulted, I think, fits in as a savings and banking alternative. If you don't want as many dollars, as in greenbacks, sitting at Wells Fargo or B of A or whoever you bank with, this gives you the ability to seamlessly move in and out into the dollar world when you need it and when you want to use it, but not to be stuck there and suffer from it.
I've got one client in particular that I'm thinking about that shows a perfect model of moving large amounts over into Vaulted and then moving some of that back out when needed. He's a farmer. And in the fall, when he takes in his harvest, he looks at the dollar and it's like, you know, I don't think I want to be in a devaluing asset. So he moves that money over into Vaulted, knowing that next spring he's going to need the money. Now, it's that liquid. He can move back, and he's done real well. Obviously, this last couple of years, he's done real well when he's sitting with by the fire in the winter, not planting, not doing anything. His money had been growing as the gold price grew.
Well, Kevin, a part of the value there, particularly for the farmer, that's such a brilliant concept, because there is some seasonality to crops, obviously, and there's also some seasonality to gold. And at least twice in this period where he's timed out of the crop market,
right,
he's actually timed into the two growth phases that gold has. And you look at both sort of Ramadan, the Indian wedding season, the Chinese New Year, you've got a couple of reasons why in the fall, prices tend to pick up, and in the first quarter, prices tend to pick up again. And so there's opportunities for him to engage gold as a liquidity vehicle and actually see a few percentage points growth along the way as he's getting ready to redeploy back to the crop cycle.
Well, and I should say, this is a client who's worked with me for 30 some odd years, okay? And so he already has plenty of physical gold in his hands, silver, platinum.
This is about liquidity management.
This is about liquidity management. And so that takes me to the next phase, because this is really cool. Okay, so let's say you're not a farmer and you just want money coming out every 2 weeks when you get paid.
$20, $50, $100,
Vaulted,
you want to put it into gold.
You can just set up a sequence where, you know, if you want $100 a paycheck to come out and go into gold, it'll do it. $10.
That's what
it'll
we call Vault Plan.
Yeah.
Vault Plan at vaulted.com. The Vault Plan allows you to automatically purchase gold on a weekly basis, monthly basis, bi-month. You set the time frames, and it automatically purchases, allowing you to dollar cost average into a position and treat it as a savings account.
Right. So whether it's a compounding ounces plan, like we talked about last week with gold and silver ratios, platinum palladium ratios, Dow gold ratios, and the liquidity management with Vaulted, there are a number of ways that a person can protect their fiat currency portfolio.
Well, and again, this goes back to, we started with assumptions, we'll end with assumptions. I view, and even though it's not popular to view gold as money anymore, and it does create a definition, a role for it, a very healthy role for it as an insurance product, I still view gold as real money.
Right.
And so Vaulted does that. It allows you to treat gold as real money and put yourself on your own sort of personal gold standard. When I look back at 2019 and anticipate the next few years, again, I think the macro case for gold ties to political uncertainty, ties to political uncertainty as it's expressed internationally. So international relations, you know, compounded problems, the blame game, scapegoating, that's how we could define geopolitical uncertainty. So political, geopolitical, and financial market uncertainty. When you get to market peaks, when you're putting in a market peak, what you're looking at is great potential energy. Great potential energy, in my view, coming into the gold market as people move from financial assets, stocks and bonds, which are clearly overvalued today, and look for an alternative. They're going to look for an alternative in dollar terms, but also look for an alternative in alternative currency terms. Because the real challenge for the dollar here is not only do we have $1 trillion in debt that we're adding to, which represents pressure to our currency going forward. How stable is it? How good a bet are we? But should we find ourselves in a real financial pickle, you've got not only the monetary policy, which is going to put pressure on the dollar, but also fiscal policy interventions, which are going to put pressure on the dollar. So we may have the perfect storm in terms of financial market uncertainty feeding demand into gold, and then all of a sudden people rethinking, how much do I want to be in U.S. dollars when the dollar becomes the whipping boy for, you know, fixing all of our problems? And so again, we don't think that creating infinite amounts of money and credit are a good idea to begin with. But when they create problems, and then you use them yet again, doubling down, using those same tools to try to fix the problems, we don't think the outcomes will be very good for investors unless you've adequately positioned in something like gold. So my case for gold is on those three things today: political uncertainty, geopolitical uncertainty, financial markets uncertainty. And yes, that translates into a very different environment here in the next few years, where the dollar could be considerably weaker than it has been in recent years, and actually interest rates could be higher than anyone anticipates, that being a critical variable to our ability to keep ourselves financed and above water, corporations, individuals, and the government included.
You've been listening to the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary. I'm Kevin Orrick, along with David McIlvaney. You can find us at McIlvaney.com, McIlvaney.com, and you can call us at 800-525-9556.
This has been the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary. The views expressed should not be considered to be a solicitation or a recommendation for your investment portfolio. You should consult a professional financial advisor to assess your suitability for risk and investment. Join us again next week for a new edition of the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary.